Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. This is the Environmental Injustice Panel, Industrial Hazards in Border Cities, and as you can tell, we'll be talking about more than just border cities. I'm Mara Lacone. I'm Editor-in-Chief of Environmental Health News. What Environmental Health News is foundation-funded journalism. You might be familiar with what we put out at EHN.org. We put out Above the Fold, which every day you can go to and you can get the 20 or some top environmental health stories from around the world. And about 4 years ago, we started doing our own enterprise journalism. I spent about 30 years at newspapers before that, and I pioneered the environmental health beat at the LA Times. And I've been covering environmental health stories for years. And I would write about BPA and PCBs and mercury and all those types of things. And I was trying to think of what type of project I could really do at EHN that would have a big impact. And I kept thinking about how it was always the low-income, poor people of color communities that seemed to be impacted the most by what I was writing about, the ones who were struggling to have the clean air and the clean food, the clean fisheries, the clean water, those types of things. And so I thought the perfect project would be to dispatch reporters across the country to write about those low-income people of color communities and what they were facing. And I have to tell you, I was pretty stunned with what everybody came back with. You know, I knew there were environmental injustices in the world. I knew that there were plenty of places like this. But it really struck me with what the reporters came back with on how ignored these communities were. Their local media wasn't writing about them. There's very little health research, and it was communities that had very little clout within their community or with the media. So what we produced was a project called Pollution, Poverty, and People of Color, and it was a 10-part series. And I have to say, I'm very proud of this. I was involved with all kinds of projects at the newspapers that I was with, but I was never so proud as one as this. What we did is we went, like I said, I sent reporters to 7 or 8 different communities. The first community was in Richmond, California. It's right outside San Francisco. And they're living with 5 refineries, 3 chemical plants, dozens of Superfund sites and other hazardous waste sites. And it's a community, like I said, right outside San Francisco. And people in San Francisco don't even really know what the people are facing there. So our first two pieces for the project, the first one was called The Factory on the Hill. And it was written with a lot of colorful stories about giving it a real sense of people and place. But it was also had the science and the data to back it up because we looked at what the people were exposed to and what studies had shown about their health effects. And another community we went to was in the Central Valley in California that had a lot of nitrates in the water, and it was mostly a Hispanic community. And then we also looked at a Native American community in Michigan that was living with the threat of a mine that was opening up and a legacy of diabetes in Alabama, Anniston, Alabama. We looked at the climate gap issues related to climate change and environmental justice, which was sort of a novel approach, I think. And we looked at a community in Boston. We looked at East St. Louis and the inner city epidemic of asthma. And then we looked back at the birth of the environmental justice movement. It's the 30th anniversary of a protest in North Carolina to protest PCB, the siting of a PCB dump there. And what our reporters found is that there's really a distressing amount of things that are still going on 30 years later. Not much has improved when it comes to this. So I'm going to pass these out so you guys can see.
Sure.
So you guys can just see some of the stories that we did. What was most distressing to me is that in one of the stories, the Central Valley one, it was a community of mostly farm workers, and they were making, you know, a few dollars an hour picking oranges, yet they were aware that they could not drink their water, their well water. It was so contaminated with nitrates, and there was nothing the water district was doing to help them. And so they were spending their hard-earned money on bottled water, and we all know how expensive bottled water is. And they just... And it struck me that the reporter was talking to them, and they thought this was just normal life. This is the way that everybody lived, that they couldn't drink their water in a major area of the United States. And they just thought that was normal. And so I thought it was our job to really tell people that this was not normal and to expose what was happening in a lot of these communities and have it really firmly grounded in science and data. Because you can tell stories about the people, but if you don't have the science to back it up, it's not that strong of a story. So I really encourage you to look in your communities. What happened after the Richmond stories, about a couple months after our series ran, there was a big fire at one of the refineries, the huge Chevron refinery in Richmond, which is one of the biggest refineries in the world, and thousands of people had to go to the hospital for what they were exposed to, high particulate levels. And we felt good that we had sort of set the groundwork for that type of thing to happen. There were accidents all the time at these refineries, and hardly anybody pays attention to them. And one of the things that I think is important is to really talk about how these are low-income people of color communities. I find that so much of the media is afraid to say that. When the Richmond accident happened, I mean, we aggregate the news, so we know what news is out there. And I saw that nobody mentioned that North Richmond is 97% African American, and it's 20% or so of the population is beneath the poverty level. Why is the media afraid to say that? I think part of it is that a lot of us were trained as reporters is that you don't mention somebody's race if it's not important to the story. I think it goes back to the old police reporting. But this is environmental reporting, and if this is an environmental justice issue, it really needs to be exposed in the press. And so it sort of floored me that the San Francisco Chronicle, right in its own backyard, would be writing about all the people in Richmond that were having health effects, and not once did they say, you know, like I said, people of color, low income. Don't be afraid to say it. It's the truth. So it just needs to be exposed and written about it in that way. And that's one of the things that we try to do at EHM. Our mission here is to talk about stories that are uncovered or undercovered, to give you some ideas about things to cover. But like I said, there's going to be places like this around the world and in your own backyard. So I think we'll start with Brian. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your group, and some of the uncovered stories that you can tell us. So,
being recorded. All right. Where's the audio guy? Is that good? Okay. So my name is Brian Barras. I live in Houston, Texas, I think about 9-10 hours from here. We're on the Gulf Coast, 45 miles from Galveston. And I'm here sort of as a rep of Tejas, which is a group that I founded with my father. It stands for Texas Environmental Justice Advocacy Services. How much time do I have?
6-5 minutes.
Okay, I'll be quick. So Tejas was founded mostly because we were realizing that no one was bringing up environmental justice issues in the Houston area and even in Texas. There was no group. There were a lot of individuals who lived in these communities who were speaking out, but there was no advocacy group to sort of help, elevate these voices. I'm also an advisor, a managing advisor for a group called the Gulf Coast Fund. It's a philanthropic organization that helps fund very small grassroots organizations along the Gulf Coast from Florida to Texas. I think what we have discovered, and people of color have to fight so many different things. Funding is one of the other big ones, right? So now we had a foundation. No one would give us money. Everyone said, get an organization and then we can help you. But they didn't, right? Because you have no history, you have no sort of, you have no history of managing money and so on. So anyway, I'm also an advisor on that. Really amazing group. Again, a number of very small EJ groups throughout the coast. They work on a myriad of issues, not just environmental issues. I'm also a media fellow for a online publication called Bridge the Gulf. Check that out. That's really cool. And lastly, I'm on a group called Nuestra Palabra. And this is really where I got my footwork on media. And it's a cultural organizing organization because what we found was we weren't being included in the narrative of present day. And we also, you know, didn't know anything about our history because that's not in the schools. And so there was a amazing cultural leader who came to Houston and founded this organization that brought Latino writers to the city. And they had a radio program, and that's how we got our feet wet. They have a radio show on Pacifica in Houston. We're both co-producers of that program, Liana and I. And so, you know, just to show you that when, you know, a community is really trying to fight for better laws, better regulations, cleaner air, better health care, to do it effectively, you really have to get into all these things, right? And that's not even included. This is just like the media side. Like, you also have to become a scientist, you know, a researcher, and many other things. So I'll leave it at that, and we'll talk about more later. So we got started because there was a school being built in the area that I grew up in, and it was next to three grandfathered petrochemical plants. This is back in 96, 97, and at the time, you know, there was not a whole lot of environmental justice reporting. It was kind of a new thing, and even, you know, in our own communities, this was sort of a new concept. If you grow up in an area that is the largest petrochemical refining complex in the country and one of the largest in the world, you sort of grow accustomed, you adapt to what that means, the smells, the headaches, the nosebleeds, you know, the nausea, the skin rashes, all those things seem normal, right, like you were saying. And because of that, it was never really linked to exposures to the chemicals that were being utilized in these facilities. So this school was being built, and my father had just come back from Louisiana. He had worked on a real big environmental justice case, and we decided that this was something we wanted to stop. We don't want this school to be built. Children are more susceptible to chemical exposure, and of course this school was 95-96% Latino community, so it was going to affect, you know, a specific population. And again, no one was really writing about this. Even our elected officials who were Latino really weren't on board. We had a serious overcrowding issue in Houston. We needed some schools. Taxpayers didn't want to fund it. The bond election failed. And so they created a tax increment reinvestment zone. And this stuff has never been reported on. This is like the really cool, sneaky stuff. Tax increment reinvestment zone is supposed to encourage development. But the zone that they created to build this school included only the petrochemical plants, wastewater treatment facility, and then the property where the school was at. So there was actually no room for any development to even come in. That gave the oil companies tax credits. So they actually, you know, got less taxes, and the students got stuck right next to them. Already there. New school. Could have been built. We had other locations that we recommended. And what they did was decide to name it after, you know, one of our leaders, after Cesar Chavez. And that sort of stifled and killed the momentum that we had going into the communities, because now it was us trying to shut down a school, you know, Cesar Chavez High School. But, you know, we continued. A lot of the things that we said sort of manifested themselves over the years. There wasn't not a whole lot of science. That's something that we had to reckon with, and we pushed for studies. There was a great piece, and this is where the media, you know, actually helped. This was amazing. There was an environmental reporter named Dina Capiella with the Houston Chronicle. She had a science background, and she developed this study and found that there were high levels of benzene along the fence line of the communities on the East End. And that just, you know, validated everything we said about where this school was going to be built and all the communities that were there. And it generated a lot more interest and a lot more push on these issues. But it had it not been for, you know, my dad talking to a photographer at the Houston Chronicle, you know, this story may have never been written. We do toxic tours and things like that to sort of introduce folks to, you know, this area of Houston. Because like you said, people, even in the same cities, you know, don't often leave their smaller communities. And people don't realize how huge the Port of Houston is, and that the Port of Houston is mostly petrochemical facilities, and that there are communities that live right next to these plants. I mean, literally fence line communities, houses surrounded by tank farms and such. So that sort of led us on to a larger fight, because the school pointed out a bigger problem. And the officials told us, Juan, Brian, if we shut down this school, you know, the kids still live there, the communities still live there, and there's a bunch of other schools there anyway. It's like, we're going to have to shut down all of them. It's like, all right, now we're talking, now we're getting somewhere. It's like, or clean up the plants, you know, enforce the law, start writing about, you know, all the violations that they just get away with. And that's sort of been our fight now. We've focused on a community in this area called Manchester, and it's completely surrounded by refineries. We've found spokespersons and families there whose children had leukemia, who have, you know, awful stories of having to deal with that, emotional baggage of feeling guilty because you could have prevented this perhaps if you just lived somewhere else. You know, that's a huge burden that families carry, and guilt. You know, they feel worthless, you know, because of their economic status or their lack of, you know, scientific knowledge on what was there. You know, they just feel like bad parents.
Wanted these jobs. They wanted these high-paying shipbuilding jobs. They wanted to live in the Bay Area, and it was the only area in part of the Bay Area where they were really allowed to live, where they could buy houses. And so there's generations of them, and they're still there. And so there's communities like this throughout the country. It's not just San Francisco. It's not just Houston. And I think the schools are really a good place to start. Look at where some of those schools are located. And as you said, they're right next to a refinery. I wrote about one that was right next to the Port of Los Angeles in Long Beach with a huge port complex. There's a school there, and the asthma rate there is phenomenal. And they have huge diesel trucks going back and forth, and there's controversies about building of a rail yard and expansion and whether clean diesel would actually improve the community or not. But there's great people and science stories that you could merge in communities like Houston and in places in California.
And there have been other studies. USA Today did a incredible story called The Smokestack Effect, and they looked at schools across the country, and they highlighted, you know, the most toxic schools. Cesar Chavez is in the 1 percentile. Most of the schools in the Houston area are in the 1 percentile. And so once these things come out, it's as if nothing happens after the fact, right? It's like, okay, now we know that these are the most toxic schools, but no one does any follow-up. No one ever goes to these communities to find the students that are living there and ask what they think, you know, and the parents what they think. And they're often very, very scared, frightened. There's a lot of pressure in these company towns, and a lot of folks, you know, Wilma Suber is a chemist in Louisiana. She's been shot at. You know, our radio station has been shot at. So there's some real serious repercussions for speaking out a lot of times in these communities as well. And so when they do come out, and I think it's very important to give them, you know, proper credit in the papers, but also follow up with them and keep track of them, because these things happen. And you know, there is a retribution. I'll stop there. There's a lot of things coming towards Houston, too. We're trying to stop the tar sands. We don't want any more stuff.
Got enough stuff.
That's like, you know, the basic premise of environmental justice, right? You already have enough pollution. Why are you bringing more? And even things that sound good at the national level, like the Cash for Clunkers program, when Obama had this legislation to get rid of old cars, to get new cars on, right, to lower the emissions. Where did all those old cars go? To the junkyards that were built in Manchester, right next to the community. And so now we have, you know, 20, 30 trucks a day coming in with old cars being shredded. No sort of lining. It's not covered. They built a wall. We like to build walls in the U.S., and apparently that keep anything out. So you know, I think even things that sound good, we need to look at them from the beginning of their life to the end of their life, period, and see which communities are being impacted. And I'll stop there.
Patricia, would you like to talk about what you're doing and what types of things are uncovered?
Yes, thank you, Mala. Very nice your invitation. Thank you very much. My concern, I was invited to speak about any potential threat in the border. And my concerns goes beyond location, specific on-site location. My concern are the families with low-income socioeconomic levels. We can include Hispanics, Mexican-Americans, immigrants, Latino, undocumented, legal residents, especially children, living, learning, and playing in housing, schools, and neighborhoods with poor and decaying physical conditions. Then they are exposed to pesticides. That's my concern. The exposure is for long-term and by multiple sources. Located in these substandard living conditions, families are demanded or called to use and overuse pesticides in any of these settings, housing, schooling, and neighborhoods. Managers and administrators and decision makers apply pesticides indistinctively and profusely in apartments, housing projects, and urban settings. Disempowered with language barriers, afraid of losing the leasing contract, or unaware of how to navigate the complaints system in the U.S., these families have no voice on stopping, spacing, or deciding where to apply pesticides in their homes. Women may be pregnant, families may have young children, and elderly or sick people may live in under such conditions. Managers and decision makers may, and most often they don't, notify tenants before application or ask permission to do it. We know that prenatal and early life exposure to pesticides are critical for organ development and cognitive development in children. So the consequences are lifelong. Being sick with asthma, allergies, or cancers are exhausting, are economically burden for these families. Once out of home, children are also exposed to pesticides in daycare centers, in schools located in such deprived neighborhoods. And for example, in 2006, 65% of schools in the U.S. inform students and staff prior to application of pesticides, just in case someone is sensitive to those applications. And 58 of those schools only use alternative means instead of pesticides, less harsh products or methods. My concern is less schools serving these disenfranchised populations are applying more pesticides, are informing less, and are asking less permission to do it in their homes or in their schools. In the border, residents encounter dual cultures, dual markets. We have access to markets in both sides of the border. I made a study in 2002 and found that 40% of residents in the U.S. that I interviewed were using Polvo de Avion, Polvo de avión is a dust plane. It's an agricultural pesticide, but, you know, we find the means for everything. And that polvo de avión is being used in residential use, for residential purposes, illegally. And not only in Mexico, in the Mexican side, but also U.S. families are going to see Juarez in my case and purchasing that product. It's very
What
available.
Pesticide is this?
It's methylparathion. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's called polvo de avión.
And it's an agricultural pesticide.
Right? Yes, it's agricultural
pesticide.
It's being used residential. In my study, 22% of the families, of 250 families, were applying it inside. And they say it's muy bueno, muy bueno pesticida, kills everything.
Yeah.
And so that's my concern. And also, we know that in the border, 70 to 80% of residents are of Hispanic origin, and especially from Mexico. And of the total population in El Paso, 57% are not citizens. 71% speak Spanish at home. And so when applying pesticides, women do not understand the risk for when they are pregnant or on early life stages of their children. And so I call this a lost in translation issue, because families move from one culture to another, but they don't quite understand the U.S. culture about risks and precautions and reading instructions on the label. Products are only with labels in English or in Spanish. Very few products have dual language in the label. And so families are torn between these two cultures. There is a loss of translation there that I call that. Also, publications, brochures, flyers, everything has the term for the pest. It says insecticide, herbicides, etc., but it doesn't say pesticides. And when I'm doing education in the community, when I say, hey, these are pesticides, and they say, well, this is pesticides. But as soon as I tell them that, for example, repellents are considered as pesticide, they are saying, oh, my gosh, I estoy usando veneno con mis hijos, because they are applying veneno, poison to their kids. And so that loss in translation between the term pesticides and organophosphates or insecticides is not linked in the minds of some people.
Is anybody at your university studying this population to see what the health effects might be?
No.
I know there's a researcher in Houston who's looking at the farm workers and families.
Oh, yes.
And I know that the study's being sort of suppressed because we found some really bad results. But also, you know, there are communities like in Mission, Texas, where they had a manufacturing plant and didn't tell the community that they were making Agent Orange there and pesticides. And it had an open ventilation system that just shot out into the community, got into the farms. And they have supposed organic, you know, orange farms in the area. There's a documentary, I don't know if it's out yet, but it's called American Orange, and it's odd, you know, they have all these orange fields, and they were making Agent Orange right here.
Yes. What I did is a study about the beliefs and practices of Hispanic women applying pesticides in their homes. But usually the majority of the studies are done with agricultural workers, and very few are about residential use. And so what I think is that this type of exposure is a synergetic, complex, and multi-source exposures to pesticides linked with border social conditions like disempowerment, scarce activism. I also find I don't see many organizations in the border using the term social justice, environmental justice, when fighting for this for improvement in their living and school and neighborhood conditions. So I see that the threat by pesticides and the health impacts here in the border become silent, invisible, and forgettable, because it's a subtle exposure here, there, and there, and the consequences and the cumulative effects are also missed, understood, or by the medical personnel. They don't see the effects unless we have an accident. We see the effects of pesticides. Otherwise, we don't see it. children may come to the health clinic with cold-type symptoms or asthma allergy for another reason, but not related to pesticide exposure, either at school or at home. And I'm speaking about those homes in housing projects, in apartments, where people have no voice about it. So that's my concern.
Well, I think as a reporter, sometimes it's difficult to cover these communities. Okay, you found a community. It seems like they're highly exposed to whatever it is, whether it's a pesticide or whether it's an industrial pollutant. And a reporter wonders, well, where do I take it from here? Because there's no scientist I can turn to actually talk about what the health effects are in this community. But what you can do is you can look at all the data that's out there from other communities. There's groups called cohorts out there where scientists have been monitoring children before they were born, when they were, what they were exposed to in the womb, up to like 20 years, and then what it means as far as health effects. So if I was writing about a border community that was exposed to pesticides, what I could do is I could go to my sources at UC Berkeley who have done a cohort there of farm worker women and children and what they're exposed to, and you would find that they found subtle effects, neurological effects, on things like children's IQ and reproductive effects and those types of things. So then you can take that very real dilemma of the people at the border who are using agricultural pesticides inside their homes, which is horrific to me, to see, okay, they're doing this, and it's a great story. It's colorful, but you want to get some science to back it up. That's how you can get the science to back it up, even if there isn't any scientific work being done in that community. Liz? In Salinas, California. Yep. Right, so it's an urban exposure dealing with pesticides. Right, exactly. I mean, it's the urban use of the pesticides and the rural use of the pesticides, and there's just a database there that is you can just mine it. It's full of great information. So that's the type of tips that I can give on that. Dr. Coronado, tell us what you're up to and what some uncovered stories.
Yes, Emma Coronado. I'm a professor of political science at the University of Texas at El Paso. I have been working on the U.S.-Mexico border all of my life because I grew up on the border in Arizona. And when I was a PhD student, I worked on a water study at the Udall Center at the University of Arizona looking at shared water resources on the U.S.-Mexico border. So I've been doing this for a long time, over 20 years. And I was showing you that picture. That is a colonia in El Paso County that I've done some work in. It's very ironic. The name of the colonia is Agua Dulce. Agua Dulce means sweet water. Well, they don't have any water. It is one of these colonias that does not have a sewer system, that does not have water. People really struggle to meet their water needs. And that trailer burned down. It was a family that had a mishap in the kitchen. The trailer burned. And, of course, those were the remnants, right? The county of El Paso started to find the family on a daily basis because they could not pick up the debris. The cost to remove that was $2,500. And the family said, if we had $2,500, we'd buy a new trailer. We'd buy a new place to live. We're not going to, and put it next to this one because we can't afford to remove it properly. So these are some of the environmental justice issues that I think we need to address. Water issues are a problem for many people in the United States, in the state of Texas. There are approximately 400,000 people that live in areas that don't have water services or wastewater services. And one of the things we need to take into account is the cost, the access, transporting water, and storing water, because it's not something that people can do. And these are folks that work very hard, intermittent jobs, low-paying jobs, don't have a lot of services in their communities, and this is a struggle just to get daily water. So when you're looking at these communities, you also need to take a look at the socioeconomic status, poverty. Do they have access to health care? El Paso is the largest urban uninsured. A third of our population has no access to any medical care. They don't qualify for Medicaid or private health insurance. A lot of people used to go to Ciudad Juarez for medical care. There's a lot of cross-border utilization of medical services. That has waned down a lot because of the violence in Ciudad Juarez. So people really are without medical care in this community. We also see that these folks are also exposed at work to pesticides, to industrial toxics, to all kinds of chemicals. There are a lot of farm workers that live in this area. They work usually in southern New Mexico and in parts of the county. And so not only do they live and work and play in an area where there are a lot of pollutants, they don't have clean water. So this is a real problem. Another thing that is critical to look at is political representation. Who represents these folks? And one of the things I can tell you as a political scientist is that public officials always do their political calculus. If I deliver water and sewer to this community, how many votes am I going to get? And when they do that cost-benefit analysis, it does not come out. Why? Because the majority of these folks do not vote. One, they're not eligible. Many of them are legal permanent residents. Many of them are undocumented. Many of them are not empowered. We all know that voters are older, more educated, have higher occupational prestiges, and have higher income. So all of these variables are absent there. Another issue that I really harp on in all of these communities is zoning. Because once you get one facility, the likelihood that you'll get another one is greater. And likelihood you get a third one is greater. Why? Because they're already there. So we need to look at zoning and who sits on those county and city zoning boards. That is a real way to empower communities. Get on that board. Those are the folks that make decisions about who will get to open a gas station where and who will be able to build an industrial factory there. And so that is very important. Let me give you some three examples of work that I've done throughout my work in the border region. One of them is in a community in southern New Mexico, close to Anthony, New Mexico. These are farm workers. They pick hatch chile, which is very popular. You know, hatch chile is like the best chile in the world. And it's the chile capital of the world. And so these folks work really long days. I mean, some of them start commuting like at 2 o'clock in the morning to be able to pick chile as soon as they can see, which is about maybe 4 or 5 o'clock, depending on the season. And they get paid very little. They have no health benefits. They don't have access to water. They live around dirt roads. And they also live in close proximity to a dairy farm. And so one of the complaints when I was doing research there for the census in 2000 were like all of these flies. And people were saying, you know, yeah, we're poor. Yeah, we work hard. Yeah, I'm tired. Yes, I have no money. Yes, I have no health care. But these flies are driving me crazy. And the flies were driving us crazy. And I had my students out there gathering data, and they were like, you know, we can't stand these flies. And the dairy farms, of course, because you have one, well, now there are like 8 of them. I mean, you have to hold your nose if you're driving from El Paso to Las Cruces because it is awful. And then there's, of course, methane, right, that is very close to the river. And so you're kind of wondering, how does all of this unfold and what impact does it have on the environment and what impact does it have on the quality of life of these poor people? So that's a serious problem that I think we need to look at. It's not just the person, the exposure, whatever, but the whole ball of wax, the politics, the things that they live surrounded by and the resources they have at their disposal. There's another community that I have been trying to raise awareness for a long time. It's called Westway. It's also in El Paso County. And their neighbor is a company called ArcelorMittal. It used to be Border Steel, and then it morphed into something else, and now it's ArcelorMittal. They have identified a cancer cluster in the vicinity of Westway. One of my colleagues, Kathy Stout, is working with the community in trying to identify the cancer cluster. This came to light because a priest who was serving that community mentioned to someone, you know, I've been a parish priest for a long time, and I have never, ever had so many funeral masses in all of my career as I've had here in Westway. And so that kind of sparked the interest. It's very difficult for those of us in the social sciences to get IRBs to work with people when you're doing human subjects. Because I'm like, you know, you're a political scientist. Why do you want to draw people's blood? I get that, and I don't want to, but we need to find teams. And right now, I can tell you that the funding that is going to do research on the U.S.-Mexico border is fixated on security. And so back in the day, when before NAFTA was signed and NAFTA was being negotiated, there was a plethora of NGOs, research. I mean, the water study was funded, right, because of NAFTA. And now we have seen that really decline. And so if I want to study, you know, high-tech sensors so I can detect people coming through the border or whatever, I'm getting funded. Our university has $6 million to do that kind of research. And it's in engineering. It's not in science and social sciences. It's not in healthcare and things like that. So we're seeing a real decline in the funding that's available and more restrictions in terms of human subjects when you're working with people.
So this community is not getting any of the attention of the researchers or the media. It's getting no attention at all.
None whatsoever. None whatsoever. And then I want to talk to you lastly about a little community, Vinton, Texas. Now, this little town is about 2,000 people, so it's not very big, and there are about 500 households. Vinton has, the majority of people have septic tanks and they have private wells. Some people don't have a proper septic system, and some people don't have a well. So it's a community that struggles. It's very poor. Basically, they have no water and no wastewater services, a system. There are resources from the Texas Water Development Board, from the Border Environmental Cooperation Commission. There's also help from the Texas Water District Board. There's Texas from the Texas Water Development Board Economically Distressed Area Program. I mean, there is money for them to begin this system. However, the city council has not approved the project. And I'm very interested in one of my books that I co-authored a couple of years ago dealt with Latinas in Texas politics. So I'm very interested in the role of women, especially minority women in Texas politics. So I've been watching this little town, and it's three women who are Mexican-American, very representative of the community, that have blocked this project. And their argument is, if we approve this, our taxes will go up, and then we have to come up with $3,800 to install a service line for the sewer, and we have to decommission our septic tanks. So do you have $3,800 to be able to do this? So, of course, we don't want the water and the sewer and the septic system. It's been very frustrating to watch this. It's been very sad to watch this. And the school district, Canutillo Independent School District, is monitoring the health of the children that come from Westway because they feel that they need to start documenting how many kids don't come to school or have diarrhea or go home sick, because they're trying to encourage people, this is the right thing to do. But these three women, and let me tell you, I've been watching this because it's fascinating. I mean, they yell at each other, they cuss at each other, they protest in front of people's homes. I mean, it is, as a political scientist, this is fascinating, but it makes me very sad. So is it a sad state of affairs? Yes. Is it an environmental justice issue? Yes. And I think that we need to raise awareness. One of the things, I was at EPA working on the border plan many years ago, and I got involved in environmental justice issues, and one of the things that people would say, you know, what is the environmental exposure, the environmental risk, and how much of it is poverty, lack of health insurance, lack of education, they drink too much, they smoke too much, they don't eat the right food? How do you tease that out? And that's the challenge, and that's where they get you in terms of actually improving services and delivering infrastructure to communities, because there is some kind of blaming people for not eating broccoli and not, you know, having your balanced meals and et cetera, et cetera. So I think for all of us, it's a challenge. It's sad that I enjoy doing this kind of research. And sometimes I wish I could find, like, voting behavior or something, you know, do what my colleagues do in political science, because I'm not a very traditional political scientist, but I really want to know how to change the world. And I think the media, once it gets out there, is critical. But the challenge I have is, like, people, I read the New York Times. Like, you know, I read the Washington Post. It's all online, you know. And I'm like, don't you read the little daily that comes out of Benton, you know, to find out? And they're like, no. And so how do we get people locally and regionally to, you know, address these issues?
We really need the reporters to actually cover their own communities.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Thank you. I think Brian had a comment.
Yeah, because y'all mentioned a lot of things, and I wanted to be quick. So I left a lot out.
Yeah.
Right. That's fine. This is important, though, too, because I think one of the things that you brought up were how communities are blamed, right? You blame the victim. And I think one really fascinating and good area to look at is social determinants of health. It's very important. And include that in your analysis. And then also in the research and we've been utilizing community-based participatory research as well, so that communities are actively deciding what gets looked at. You know, they're part of the process from the beginning to end, and that makes them much more likely to participate in a study when their blood's going to be drawn, their urine's going to be sampled, you know, all those things. So I just wanted to mention those two things, you know, and cumulative impacts that you brought up is also very, very important, because we tend to see articles written about one specific chemical and not take into effect, like in Houston, we have diesel particulate matter. We have the chemicals from the plants. We got the ozone. We got, you know, go on and on and on. Pesticides, you know, all these sorts of things. And they're all sort of related and linked and need to be sort of brought out in these stories as well.
You can go to a local air quality district and see exactly what people are exposed to. Let's go to questions now. Let's start with SEJ members, and please state your name and affiliation.
Sure. So basically a question about sort of cultural risk to their culture as well. I mean, they're telling them not to eat their native foods and live in their native lands.
We're running out of places to go, right? There are no clean spaces anymore. But you brought up a memory, because I have a friend who's a fisherwoman and married to a shrimper in Louisiana. And she ended up in Louisiana because she was escaping and leaving, you know, a very toxic situation in the Houston area. And, you know, she went through this incredible fight with a really amazing scientist, Dr. Marvin Legater at UTMB. And she just left. She's like, you know, forget it. I'm leaving. Her kids were getting sick. And she ends up in coastal Louisiana, Barataria. And now we have this oil spill. And so it's interesting, and you know, we hear the same thing of, like, breast milk, right, for women. It's like, oh, don't feed your babies. It's like, well, I thought that was the best thing to do. So now with the seafood, you know, is it safe? Is it not safe? You know, I thought wild catch fish was the best food to have. So I think we do need to focus on cleaning up. We can't keep passing the buck. We're running out of opportunities to clean this stuff up. We've got thousands of chemicals that have never been tested. We don't know what their synergistic effects are. And so, yeah, there's a lot of unknowns. All these ailments we have, you know, get researched to death. But no one wants to talk about eliminating the chemicals that are causing it in the first place. And so I think you're spot on, and I'd love to see more writing about that.
I see that. I noticed that in pesticide use, scientists and governments and producers are blaming the victim, are saying that to the end user to change their habits, but not take the responsibility of them producing and developing that kind of chemicals that, yes, they are designed to kill, but they don't realize that culture, habits, our own lifestyle, the substandard housing are producing that the end user will be the victim, and it's easier for the producers to say, it's up to you. It's up to you to eat that fish. It's up to you to use that product. It's up to you. And we have to remember that in environmental justice, we have to link social issues, disempowerment, and poverty. And this group of population, they can only afford that housing. They can only afford that land. They can only afford that kind of car or live in that area. So it's those are issues that we as media and researchers and educators, we can focus on. Instead of blaming the victim, we have to make responsible the producers of that.
Liz, you have a question. Very expensive and time-consuming.
It's very expensive, time-consuming, and we need to establish collaborations. And we also use pretty much the community-based participatory research approach. It's difficult now with the lack of funding and collaboration with those studies. We can replicate the same studies if we have the funds. Another issue, we have scarce participation from the community. I found over 700 organizations in a directory about environmental justice from the University of Michigan. Only 40 were located in Texas. Of those 40, only 7 were located in the border, in border counties. So even though some organizations are fighting for and to improve the environment, they don't relate that to social issues. They don't relate that to disparities, to social determinants. And so it's difficult to make that kind of study. It's time consuming. It takes a while. And also we have another caveat is that proving the cause of the disease or the health outcome is very difficult in environmental issues because we have individual characteristics, biology, exposures, time of exposure, what synergetic effect with other substances. So it's difficult to prove cause and effect, but we can do it in any way.
Yeah, I just want to add to that. Many of our colleagues in the academic world are very concerned with tenure and publications. And so they want to know, if I'm going to spend so much time on this study, what are the venues for publication, the journals that are going to be publishing these things? Are they ranked? Is the impact factor important? And if not, they would rather do something that will yield very quick research results that can get them published. I mean, I work in that world. I get it, you know.
So there's a whole industry, right, of researchers and such.
Yes.
I know APHA is like a big conference where a lot of communities hopefully meet researchers. But, you know, that's the problem. The burden is on the community to prove that they're being contaminated. Mm-hmm. That's messed up. And really what we fight for is the precautionary principle. You prove that it's safe before you put it out there. And there's this notion of acceptable risk, right? Well, you know, some folks are going to die. And that's okay. And we're not okay with that either. This notion of sort of a risk assessment is a whole other industry. Yeah.
Yeah, there needs to be a meeting with funders, researchers, and community. And then you come together and you're like, this is how we're going to develop this research project. Because there are people that are being tired of being studied to death. It's like how much, and you know, imagine, you know, I asked my colleagues, how would you like it if someone came to your door, knocked on the door and said, oh, we're doing a study of, you know, whatever, and so we're going to draw your blood. Really? I can't imagine. You know,
it's
this
pretty
is,
invasive.
I can't imagine. It's very invasive, and I can't imagine. You know, here in Texas, you have to be very careful. You know, people have guns and stuff. I mean, you know, so it's like, would I have the, you know, fortitude to go and knock on someone and say, you know, gee, I really would like for you to pee in this cup and let me draw some blood.
And science does not have a good history of working with people of color either.
That's right. Yeah.
More questions. I have to go to journalist questions first, so. Okay, good. Who are you and where are you from? Oh, of course. I sat next to you yesterday. I'm sorry. The question. The question is about people and communities balancing jobs and environmental threats.
So I think in Manchester there are not a majority of folks that work in these factories. It can, but you know, we have other situations. So we have a lot of undocumented folks that live in these areas. So by the nature of their political status, they're depoliticized and they don't want to, rock the boat. It's a right-to-work state also. We have no zoning. There's all sorts of things that sort of make it really hard. And I would say that that's not necessarily one of them, that, you know, the communities work in these plants, this specific one. That is an issue, but I think what happens in the press is they'll just take that statement from a company, you know, that they're going to lose jobs. Well, prove it, you know. And what kind of jobs? And how long are they going to be there? And are you going to hire folks from this community anyway? And, you know, there's a lot deeper discussion that should be had when those claims come up. I mean, they lied blatantly about the Keystone XL pipeline, and sometimes even the truth doesn't really matter. They'll just move to another lie. I think jobs, that needs to be a deeper analysis when people are dying. That's more important to me, I think, than a job.
That's been the issue in Westway with ArcelorMittal. Many of the people work for ArcelorMittal. And they, absolutely, oh my God. And it's caused some terrible conflicts among the neighbors, because those of you complaining are going to lead us to lose our jobs.
And that's an issue in Richmond with the big Chevron refinery.
Yeah, that has been a real serious, and that it leads to a lot of contentious relationships. It's not good.
More questions? Peter?
You know, I have been looking at what has happened to the non-governmental organizations on the border that used to focus on environmental issues, cross-boundary, the transboundary impacts of pollution, et cetera, and where they are now. I have been interviewing people. One person in Tijuana told me that back at the height of NAFTA, there were about 300 NGOs in Tijuana registered, working on all kinds of things. Now there are about 5. He's a pessimist. The optimist told me there are about maybe 30 to 40. So it has definitely waned down. The Big Ten have been called to the carpet, and all of them now have, you know, some office, some number, environmental justice. They do some community work. But what I see is that they're focusing more on, for example, the silvery minnow, very important in the Rio Grande. They're focusing on endangered species. People, not so much. And that's, you know, the Sierra Club had an anti sort of, what was perceived to be an anti-immigrant. The problem are the people, you know, not the consumption, but the people. And so that too has that's not been a good move, I think. But I'm also working on a report card on the Big Ten, but what I see is they're looking at, the wolf in New Mexico, for example, is important. That is important. I mean, everyone needs to do their part. You know, I tell my students, there's a fire, the forest is burning, the animals are running for their lives, and the lion and the hummingbird are running together, and the hummingbird keeps coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. The lion says, "What are you doing, hummingbird?" And he said, "Hey, I'm going to get water to put out this fire." He said, "How much water can you carry in your beak?" And he said, "Hey, I'm doing my part." And I get it. You know, I think all of us, in some way, you have to do your part, because this is a behemoth. And it's overwhelming.
And I know we have somebody from the Fish and Wildlife Service. We were just talking about our past. Yeah. Who talks? I know. And it's sort of like, if it's endangering a creature, it's probably endangering human health too. So I think you can address that.
Yeah, we had a case in El Paso about the ASARCO, the smelting industry, and Sierra Club was helping people to fight, and they were very active in trying to close the industry. And finally, the industry was closed. But I observed that never the term environmental justice or people was coming to the discussion. Never. Was all the damages to the air, to blah, 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 and sometimes they said, "Oh no, but the air goes to Mexico, and who cares," or whatever. But I didn't hear in that discussion for years the term environmental justice. Apparently were fighting for the people living around the area. EPA came down, collected soil and some blood samples, and try to fix and remediate some front and back yards. But we're on the wealthiest neighborhoods close to the Sarco site. I never heard about the term environmental justice. What about people, as Dr. Cornell said? What about people?
There was also, you know, with the building of the border wall, there was a lot of discussion about, you know, affecting the habitat of these animals that know no borders, right? But, you know, the immigration or the anti-immigrant and the very conservative right-wing groups in Arizona and in New Mexico and in Texas, I mean, they trumped everything. Because we got the border wall without even an environmental impact statement. Yeah, no environmental laws. You know, forget about them because, you know, the Mexicans are coming. And so, you know, I don't think they realize the Mexicans are already here, but, you know. Well, that's right. I grew up in Nogales. Yeah. Yes, of course. Of course. Well, my chapter has that section in there. Yeah. Nogales, Arizona is here. Nogales, Sonora is here. And so when it rains, everything, and it doesn't rain very often, but when it does, it is huge. And that flood is very devastating to the community.
We've got like 3 more minutes before we get kicked out. So I'm going to try to squeeze in some more questions. And I know you've had your hand up for a while. Go ahead.
There's one thing I've learned in some of these communities is that's great that the media is out there, whatever, but many of them don't have access to what's on the internet, to resources, to databases. So I go to all these go to this database and go here and check this and check the air quality. Well, they don't have that wherewithal. And so we need more community education to help people access that information for their own benefit. We've done a little bit of that in Westway, but it's hard. And I think one of the things that I see as an educator, a real need to educate minorities in STEM-related fields. You know, a lot of my students, I want to be an environmentalist, I want to recycle. I'm like, no, become a chemist. You know, become a toxicologist. That's what we need. And you know, some of these kids, oh, that's hard. You know, and I'm like, well, yeah, but, you know, these solutions are hard too. But I always remind them of the hummingbird, you know.
I'll give you each of you 30 seconds. Sorry for the 30 seconds to finish up. So.
Okay. 1 minute for me. I just wanted to tell you to address this book that recently was released by several researchers and professors at the University of Texas at El Paso. It includes a section about immigration, women, colonias, water issues, and also environmental justice. How in all the border, in both sides of the border, U.S. and Mexico. So you can find more information about the border and environmental justice issues in this book. Social justice in the U.S.-Mexico border region.
Brian? All right. And I just wanted to say thank you. And I do have some thumb drives, but you have to give me your business card. And on this is a lot of information on issues that we've been working on in the Texas area and in the Gulf Coast area. And there's also contacts of EJ leaders across the U.S. There's some videos also on projects that I've worked on and things like that. And then let me pimp one book since we did mention Arizona and there's been a lot of talk about immigration. This is a badass dude, Jeff Biggers. He's an environmentalist and sort of a cultural writer too. And this is his new book. He's on tour right now walking around the country pimping this. So check it out.
My orders from Jay are to go straight to the ballroom so they can get the plenary started, the lunch plenary.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Did you get one?
Thank you.